The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
A greater number of Americans have now died from coronavirus than were killed in the First World War. The latest official figure is 120,000 deaths. Hundreds of new deaths are still being recorded every day in the U.S.
A lot of folks are probably sitting there going, okay, we have this 46,000 number of cases. Sounds terrible, is terrible, but we are testing more. And many of those cases we now know are young people who don't get as sick. So is that needed context right now? How do you see it?
So context is always important, and what we know is the following. First of all, we have very good evidence that this is not just about more testing. Hospitalizations are going up, and we are clearly identifying more infections, and more people are getting infected, so it's not just about more testing. You know, in terms of young people, I have two comments. I mean, first is we know young people can get pretty sick as well. We just heard about the teenager who died. We don't know the long-term effects of this disease, but more and more evidence suggests that there may be real consequences. And then, of course, young people don't just stay among young people. They go spend time with their parents and grandparents and get other people sick.
Why, though, do you think that, and it's not just the IMF, but other institutions as well, have been slow to realize the magnitude of what is happening to the global economy? What is it that you think that has caused that kind of creeping appreciation of the damage that is being done?
Well, I mean, this is a crisis like no other, as we've been saying, which means trying to figure out its impact is a true challenge, because to determine the impact, you have to answer questions like, how are people's behavior going to change? Are they going to want to stay home rather than go out and spend? And how long will they want to do that? And these are very hard to predict. But what we have seen is that the lockdowns have been very severe. Now, we are seeing recoveries, but it is uneven, which is that you certainly have some sectors like retail sector. We saw the numbers in the U.S. that came up. They look good. But on the other hand, if you look at contact intensive sectors, those are leisure, hospitality, tourism, travel. I mean, those are still, are at a real deep low and barely recovering. So I believe this is what we're looking at. And second is that this is a global crisis, which means that for a country that is very heavily dependent on exports, I mean, even if domestically you're doing okay, you're going to have a big hit to growth.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Well, more good news on the economic front. Unemployment claims remain steady, and consumer spending jumped by over 8% last month. But the increase in COVID cases, spiking to a daily record of 40,000, has spooked the markets and now raises questions about an economic rebound. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Dave Nikoski from Vermilion Research joins me at the top of the hour. Dave sees divergences between the major indexes, with tech outperforming. An elevated VIX makes for choppy markets, and Dave is very bullish on the precious metals sector. Still, he thinks this is a bull market as long as key levels of support hold for the major indexes. And Marshall Atkins from Raymond James joins me as he makes the case for much higher oil prices towards the end of the year and into 2021. He sees $70 oil and explain why it's directly ahead of us. Chris Poplava and Chris Sheridan will be here with another edition of Smart Macro to discuss why the consensus is changing on COVID, its impact on the economy, and why we have reduced our equity positions to below neutral at minimum risk. Also, be sure to read my next installment of The End of Money, The Transition from Paper to Things. But first, let's find out what moved the markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
Thanks, Jim. The tug of war continues to persist, really, since the S&P 500 hit a recent high 2 weeks ago between concerns over COVID-19 cases rapidly spreading in early open states such as Arizona, California, Texas, and Florida that could stall opening those economies further or at worst shut them down again, versus improving economic data supporting the argument that the economy is opening up. We need the economy to open up to improve GDP, but therein lies the rub and increases the chance of COVID-19 spreading. It surely is a thread the needle moment for the U.S., And luckily, there continues to be ample support from the Federal Reserve, who has done much to support the financial markets and to cool speculation from going wild with cautionary remarks. Here were some of the key stories that moved the market this week. The financial sector was a key sector this week on two issues. The first is that the Federal Deposit Insurance Commission, the FDIC, was planning to roll back on some regulations applied to banks in the wake of the financial crisis. And secondly, stress test results that have led the Federal Reserve to place restrictions on banks from being too generous in their buybacks and dividend payments. So a little bit of tug of war in the financials this week as well. So here's the details on those two items. Financials led the rally at the end of the day on Thursday on news from the FDIC that they plan to reduce restrictions related to the Volcker Rule, allowing banks to better invest into venture capital and other similar funds. Additionally, banks will be able to clear up some funds that were set aside in a sense on derivative trades between different units of the same firm. So both of those measures would free up billions of dollars for the financial sector to reinvest in better areas. That news led to a very nice rally on Thursday in the S&P 500 with the financials carrying the day. Now last week, the Fed Vice Chair Quarles on Friday announced that a new stress capital buffer framework was added, along with three economic recovery scenarios to their review on banks as it relates to stress testing and the outlook for the pandemic. Those results were announced Thursday after the market closed, and as a result of the stress test, the Federal Reserve announced it will be restricting share buybacks and capping dividend payments by banks in the third quarter. So stocks on Friday took a tumble with financials leading the downside. And as I'm reviewing things here for the podcast, the S&P 500 sectors, the financials are down 4.3%. Communication services are close behind, down 4.1%, with energy a close third, down 3.8%. The second major item this week was on news related to, like I mentioned, COVID-19 cases being on the rise and the measures certain states are taking to fight back. New York's Governor Cuomo announced that hotspot states with cases on the rise would have to quarantine for 14 days upon entering New York. And we had been tracking Texas pretty closely this week, listening in on what their hospital bed capacity was and incubator utilization. And there were remarks, I think, earlier this week that they would hit capacity next week. Guess what? Later this week, they announced that they were there. So on Friday, Texas Governor Abbott rolled back on some of the reopening provisions, cutting back capacity to 50% for restaurants, meaning they can't have more than 50% of their capacity potentially with customers, and closing down bars again from in-store customers. They can deliver, I think, but can't have any customers inside anymore. So the growing concern is that the economy will recover slower than expected. In addition to these COVID-19 measures, there were rumors that Europe may take a harder stance against U.S. travelers into Europe with a potential ban, just as they move forward with their July 1st plans to relax border restrictions. And speaking of Europe, there were reports this week that the U.S. may be considering a $3.1 billion new export tariff on the EU, while the EU is planning to move ahead with a digital tax plan. So despite all the COVID-19 concerns, quarter-end rebalancing out of stocks and overbought conditions 2 weeks ago, the stock market has held its own fairly well. The bulls coming into the S&P 500 defense right near that 200-day moving average. There's been a lot of discussion about that level this week, and on Friday closed at 3020. That's where the 200-day moving average is as of Friday. So keep your eyes peeled on that level next week as the bulls and bears continue their tug of war. We've reduced our own stock allocations for clients back below neutral positions in the past 2 weeks as a sort of precautionary measure, but we're not buying bonds either, so taking a wait and see approach. Jim, back to you for the technicals, which should, I think, be the final answer for all the conflicting bullish and bearish catalysts out there right now.
I think people get politics and policy confused, and we like to point out, you know, politics is that emotion, that debate, you know, that it's, it is sexier, it catches more headlines and gets more attention in the media, but at the end of the day, it rarely results in actual policy change or policy trends. And so we focus all of our effort on seeing where there's policy shifting or where there's, you know, policy supporting an entire sub-industry group. You know, healthcare innovation, this one's really interesting, right? With people, you know, afraid to go into their healthcare facilities or go see their doctor in person, telemedicine has really taken off. And you've, I'm sure, heard that in other places, but we are already positioned for that transition to more efficient delivery of healthcare, because that is what, you know, kind of the second phases of ACA or Obamacare are pointing to, really more efficient delivery of healthcare, quality over quantity. And we are already positioned there because policy led us there.
As always, if you'd like to hear this full interview, in addition to our three other interviews airing every week on FS Insider, just go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Are you tired of earning a minimal interest rate on your investments? Are you looking for a higher rate of return on your money? Financial Sense Wealth Management has put together a portfolio of high dividend paying blue chips, high quality interest paying bonds, and preferred stocks. Our income account portfolio is specifically designed to help meet the needs of retirees, pension funds, and foundations looking to increase income and reduce taxes. To learn more, contact us at 888-486-3939. Or email grow@financialsense.com.
Well, markets have been pulling back lately. Is this just a consolidation, a small correction? Are the markets still in a positive trend? Well, let's find out. Joining me on the program from Vermilion Research is Dave Nikoski. Dave, let's begin with the three major indexes. There seems to be some divergence between, let's say, the NASDAQ versus the Dow versus the S&P. I'd like to get your comments there.
Yeah. Hi, Jim. Thanks for having me on. Well, you know, I think it's a concern to us that, you know, the advance in the NASDAQ, especially within the confines of technology and media communications, in terms of the internet related names, you know, the divergence is fine, but it can't go on forever. You know, I think there's a great amount of concern about, you know, the magnitude of the advance that we've seen within those areas of the market. You know, as a technician, I'd like to see the rest of the market pick up and start to close that gap. You do have bottoms in a number of sectors. Back in, you know, back in May, late May, we, you know, upgraded a number of sectors to market weight from an underweight. And, you know, while I think they've made their bottoms, I also believe that, you know, at some point in time, whether it's value versus growth or tech, that, you know, we need to really see for a healthy market overall. We need to see some, you know, again, we need to see that gap closed in terms of performance. You know, I don't, you know, I guess I'm a firm believer that we can't live on software and tech alone, you know, and that was the biggest beneficiary of the, you know, at post the COVID breakout, that, you know, most companies moved online, moved their staff to their homes, bought them PCs and utilized technology to, you know, continue to work from home. I guess the big concern and the $64,000 question is whether or not those companies will continue to, you know, profit or advance in, you know, in light of a second breakout. And I think that's what the market's weighing right now. If we get a secondary breakout, they can continue their run. But, you know, the second derivative in terms of growth of those companies may, you know, begin to dissipate as most firms have ramped up their technology spending, and the advance for, you know, a quarter or two out may slow down.
You know, the one thing that has still remained positive, which is consumer discretionary, but let's talk about a couple of the sectors that aren't doing well and if that spells trouble. And I'm talking about industrials and the financial sector.
Yeah. You know, when I look at both of the charts and using the popular ETFs like XLI or XLF, you know, they're back at a significant support level right here. You know, we again remain constructive on the overall market. You know, we're looking for these pullbacks and continue to believe that, you know, we would be a buyer on the pullbacks, and especially within those, the confines of industrials and financials. I think the bank area is probably the area that, you know, maybe most hurt by the COVID in terms of forbearances on mortgage and that type of thing. But, you know, being at a support level down here on both of those, you know, I'm not ready to throw in the towel and raise the white flag. The Fed has spent very little of the stimulus money. That number today was about 6.2% of their firepower has been used. So, you know, I think any dramatic decline in the Fed's definitely going to step in to, I think, support the financial industry overall. So I guess that's probably less of a concern, you know, looking at several months out. Industrials, again, you know, we can't live off of tech and software and semis forever. It would be nice to see, you know, the rest of the economy pick up. And, you know, when you look at something like the RV industry, for instance, you know, and it's consumer discretionary is how we have that particular group. But, you know, Thor Industries was coming out and, you know, just about a month ago and saying that they, you know, couldn't, they've seen a surge in RVs, you know, over the $100,000 mark, and that they couldn't literally keep up in building them. So I think the consumer is really stepping up with these low interest rates, and being that most people aren't going to be traveling, and you can certainly see that in the travel industry, I think there's the cocooning effect, much like what we saw post 9/11, is taking place now, and it can continue for several months.
What about somebody, you know, there for a period of time, it was kind of the safety trade. People were in utilities, consumer staples, they were in REITs, interest rate oriented type of funds plus technology. So it seemed like it was defense plus technology. Now, as I look, you know, you have real estate hitting its lower moving averages. You have the same thing going on with utilities breaking down. What is that telling you?
Well, I think it's investors looking for growth areas of the market, knowing that the GDP is going to be, you know, pushed lower from this COVID outbreak. I think the one way to, you know, sidestep any concerns regarding the economy overall is to find, you know, areas of growth within the economy, despite, you know, the declining GDP that we're going to see, you know, within the second quarter and third quarter.
So as you look at this, I mean, what do you do as an investor? I mean, obviously, technology is still in an uptrend. It's holding up much better than any of the other indexes or any of the other sectors. Is this just a one-man show?
Well, it is right now in terms of performance. And again, the big question I'm getting from clients is, how long is that going to continue? And when are we going to see the gap between growth and value, you know, start to diverge? And it's been diverging a heck, but when is it going to diverge the other way? And I think we really need to see an overall pickup in the economy. And I think that's probably what could, you know, push value stocks up.
Do you think it's going to take something like the calming of COVID, or either we come out with some kind of vaccine or something? Like today, on the day you and I are speaking, Texas is pausing on some of its reopening and kind of pulling back. And we've seen areas, Dave, that were doing very well. For example, my own state of California, Arizona, Texas, and Florida were holding up well until recently. And now it looks like a second wave.
Yeah, and I would, you know, whether we call it a second wave, I think it's more the aspect that we're opening up. The social distancing measures put in by most states, you know, the way I view it is, you know, all we wanted to do was slow the spread. We weren't going to stop it. And with the opening up, I think this is still part of the first wave that we're seeing. It's just that we slowed it down to mitigate, you know, the movement into ICU beds. So I do think that, you know, social distancing will still be something that we have to deal with until there's a frontline therapy treatment or a vaccine. You know, however, vaccines, as we know, with the flu are not 100%. They can be in a range of 50 to 60%. You're still going to have the other 40% exposed. And if we get a mutation, you know, that escalates, you know, then we might warrant that vaccine is not effective.
What about also as a result of COVID, how it's changing the economy, the sectors that are doing well? As you said, we've seen technology and software do well. We're seeing, you know, instead of getting on an airplane, going to a conference, people are doing Zoom conferences now. A lot of companies are saying, you know what, we don't need as much commercial office space. Consumers are shopping online. You mentioned Thor Industries. You know, I'm very much involved in RVs. And I mean, the RV sales are just going through the roof because it's another way of actually traveling and cocooning. You stay in your own house, which is your RV.
Exactly. You know, my concern looking out, and if we had to use another time period as an example, you know, post 9/11, you know, what you saw is, and one of the communication devices at that time, if you may recall, was the Polycom device, which surged. You know, most conferences were done over the Polycom system. Now you have, something with a video on it, like a Zoom. The one thing that does is what you're going to see, and you're seeing it now, is other technologies, companies, the barriers to entry into video conferencing is moot in terms of the technology advances we have and the internet fiber that we have out there. I think that what you're going to see is you're going to see a lot of entrances into that field. And along with that is you're going to see, at least, over the next year, you're going to see a number of products be developed and put out there that are going to compete with Zoom. And Polycom, it was a great stock in its day, but you don't see Polycom like you used to. I believe they were consumed by Cisco. With that, technology is always has some great advancements, but it's also a deflationary product. And that is that you can increase productivity. And especially as competition takes place, the price of that competitive nature of it will drive the prices down. So fads are great as long as they last. And then when they start to unwind and you have competitive pressures, you're going to see that is going to dissipate, those types of stocks.
What about the consumer discretionary space? I mean, so far it's held up fairly well. Consumers have money. The government is putting a lot of dollars into their pocket. There's even talk about another stimulus package coming at the end of July that'll put money in. But I can't help but believe, Dave, that this whole consumer discretionary space is going to change over the next year as a result of COVID.
Yeah, I think you're going to have, once we open up, you're going to start to take away some market share from the online shopping. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Even with the restaurants opening, you're seeing the likes of a Costco, Target, Walmart, their relative performance has been dissipating for some time. So I think the same is going to happen on the retail front, but I do think that, if we get this, whether you want to call this a continuation of the first wave with the, rubber band being stretched that we're starting to open. And again, I don't know if we call it a first wave or second wave, but yes, we're definitely going to get more cases. But as the retailers do open up, they're going to start to take away market share from those that were online or those stores where the government, funneled everyone into, in the big box stores, like I said, the Costco, Target, and Walmarts of the world, grocery stores. And once we open up, it's going to be a little different playing field.
And what about, let's talk about two other areas that also impact the market, and I'd like to get your take on. Let's talk about gold. We have the price of gold up, roughly about 16% for the year. Silver is kind of lagging behind, but it's up. But let's talk about the gold stocks, because the gold stocks recently have been on fire.
Yeah. What's interesting is when you look at the ratio of gold to some of the popular ETFs out there, like a GDX or GDXJ, the stocks have not moved nearly as much as the commodity itself, which is highly unusual. Silver, it looks great. We're bullish long-term on the precious metals overall. I think once we see industrial start to do better, I think that can certainly help the silver industry as they are a consumer of silver. I think that, when we look at even something like the gold versus the copper ratio, you are seeing that, even copper is doing quite well on a relative basis, even versus gold. So it does suggest that, the economy is picking up a little more. What I found interesting, and as a side note, is, the Baltic Dry Index is up about 300% since May 14th. And I think that bodes extremely well for the industrial complex that we're starting to see, a surge like that in shipping prices.
So what would you like to see? We've talked about this divergence that we now see between the major indexes with technology and the NASDAQ obviously leading the way. So what would be some key factors you would want to see to tell you that this bull market remains on track?
Yeah, I think the one thing that historically, when we look back at reversals of deep bear markets, I would like to see, the emerging markets, which have been decimated, have underperformed for 10 to 12 years. Just start to put its head up above, some of the resistance levels that I see on a relative strength chart. You started getting that last week, and with yesterday's activity, it took a little wind out of the sails, but, I still see that those markets are turning up. I think that, we would like to see bond yields actually move up. I think that would be very beneficial for the financial sector. And I think would be a indication, at least by investors, that the economy is recovering and therefore higher interest rates are going to come into play. And I think that's the telltale sign that things are improving or not as bad as what we might think they were yesterday. So it's a combination of all three, but historically emerging markets. I would rather see, instead of the U.S. be the leader of the world, and it's great that we are, but it's much better if we get an advance out of the global markets rather than just the U.S. alone.
Let's talk about something else that still remains elevated, although it's down from its peak, and that's the VIX. Normally, when you see these upsurges in the market, and it's over a longer period of time, this one being a very fast and furious, not only trip down, but trip up, and that's the VIX, which still remains elevated.
Yeah, you know, the VIX can stay elevated for quite some time. When you look back at the 2008-2009 financial crisis, you know, the VIX moved down all the way from November to March, and yet the market went to new lows. So, you know, just with the VIX being elevated, I just think it adds to uncertainty. But we could trend down from here, and we may still continue to have, you know, some type of market pullback. I think that, you know, to weigh all the evidence just on the VIX itself, which is only, in my opinion, an indication of uncertainty. You know, I think the markets like certainty, and obviously we're not, based on investors' reactions and what the VIX level is, I think that there's a lot of uncertainty out there, whether it's COVID or the race relations here in the United States. There's a number of factors, I think, playing into it, as well as the elections.
And that's my next question. Typically, when we get into September and October, they tend to be stormy periods for the market. This year may be a little bit more stormier because we have such a divergence between the philosophy of both candidates. As we get into late September and October, how much of an impact do you think the election will weigh on the markets themselves, depending on what the polling data is telling us?
Yeah, I think that it's going to weigh on the market pretty heavy. I think the Fed is still going to be at bay and support, you know, and the Treasury are going to support anyone that's elected at this point. I think there's just too much uncertainty out there about the economy, and I think we're going to, you know, have significantly higher unemployment rates than, you know, than we did 4 years ago.
So as an investor, given what you see right now, we know that technology is leading the markets. It's the leading index, the XLK, one of the leading sectors within the S&P. As an investor, what would you do? Would you wait on the sidelines and wait for these other sectors to start confirming? Would you put, or would you just stick with a one-trick pony and just stay in technology?
Yeah, I never like it when, you know, one sector or a very narrow area of the economy advances by itself. I believe that, you know, we are extremely extended, and even, you know, pre-COVID, you know, when you look at how extended the XLK was from the 200-day. It was as extended as any other time in history, and we are almost at that same extension now. And that gives me, a concern that, you know, we could see the rotation back into, you know, the emerging markets, back into value versus growth. I think the biggest question is how long does this continue? And it's going to continue until it can't, and until we see that inflection. I think the smart move is keep you know, the bulwark in technology until you get that reversal. And then I think you need to trim some positions and start to move it, you know, across those other areas of the market that underperformed.
So from your perspective at the 40,000 foot level, you still see this as a bull market trend?
I do. I see some small cracks taking place, you know, just in the last day. But those cracks, you know, we have strong support right around the 2950 level on the S&P 500. Our previous one was 3100 that we just cracked through. So, you know, if we started to move below the 2950 level, I'd become more concerned.
All right. Well, listen, Dave, as we close, you want to tell our listeners about a lot of the work that you guys do at Vermilion, pretty comprehensive coverage of the markets and the various sectors. So talk about that for a minute, if you would.
Well, we've created our own sectors and groups, and so it's all proprietary. We utilize relative strength. Our data goes back to 1969. We don't have survivorship bias, so we still have the Eastern Airlines, Standard Oil in our chart, and I think that gives a great representation of historically what happened in the markets rather than looking at something like the S&P. We see a lot of, you know, strategists look at the S&P over time. You know, it is a survivorship bias index. And I think looking at, you know, the market historically to see behavior patterns, I think that can aid a lot in looking for future leadership. And history and relative strength would certainly suggest that. So we broke the market down into 12 sectors. We have about 440 groups, all proprietary. And again, without the survivorship bias, I think it represents a great tool to navigate the markets. We can, you know, view the markets in many different ways, and we do a bottom-up approach and a top-down approach. All of our groups are calculated in an unweighted basis, but we break it out by large cap, mid cap, small cap, and micro cap in those groups that, that can be divided up.
All right. And how could they find out? You want to give out your website, Dave?
Yes. It is vermilioncap.com, 1L in Vermilion. And our number is 952-922-7500.
All right, Dave, thanks so much. Stay safe and come back again.
Thanks, Jim.
Social distancing means financial Armageddon for commercial real estate and municipalities in coming months. That's according to the view of Chris Whalen, chairman of Whalen Global Advisors and the editor of the Institutional Risk Analyst. He is also the author of numerous books and is regularly consulted on banking, mortgage finance, and fintech.
We had a big, big build in commercial real estate around the U.S. Cities like New York, Los Angeles, Miami, all of the northwest corner of the country, huge growth. And what this did was it created a stock of properties that were dependent upon a certain pattern of usage, a certain amount of tourism, a certain amount of people going into the city every day for work, that sort of thing. And then COVID-19 shows up, and we are suddenly forced to work at home, and luckily technology was there to enable that. The trouble, however, in commercial is that the usage patterns have now changed. And it's almost like we ripped away the old legacy world because we could, and we have tech that lets everybody work outside of the office, let's put it that way. So we have all of these assets, all of these cities. And then think about hospitality, think about hotels, think about entertainment, anything that required density, anything that required people to come to a certain building and use it is now disrupted. So think about what that does for prices, just generally, across the entire $5 trillion worth of commercial real estate assets.
To listen to this full interview with Chris Whalen, in addition to our other three interviews that air every week on FS Insider, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button. Chris Whalen also discusses how this is going to impact inner cities, how this is going to lead to a restructuring of debts, impact this is going to have on state and local finances, as well as the effect that he believes this should have on the economic recovery in the months and years ahead. You definitely don't want to miss what he has to say. Again, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button to listen to this full interview through our website or through a podcast app of your choice on your mobile device.
Well, since reaching a bottom in April, we've seen the price of energy take off. On the day we're doing this interview, we've got oil finally broaching the $40 mark. Joining us from Raymond James is Marshall Atkins. Marshall, let's talk about where we were from April and where we've come forward. You know, we got down to levels in the oil markets, actually negative at one point, to levels I've never seen in my lifetime, to where we are today at $40.
Right. Well, obviously, there was we've seen unprecedented demand destruction for energy when you shut down, you know, most of the global economies and shut down travel between not just cities but countries. Then we use oil to move around, and so demand destruction in the month of April has been estimated to be as much as 30%. Year over year. Keep in mind that if you go back historically, to see demand down 1% for a year is extremely rare. So this is something that we've never seen, and obviously it shocked the market. What we weren't prepared from an inventory standpoint and an oil flow standpoint. And so you had some dislocations that did drive oil to what most of us thought was an impossible negative number, but there we were in April. Since then, it's intriguing. We have had a substantial improvement off the bottom in demand as economies around the world reopen, and it started with China first and is gradually going to the rest of the world. And on top of that, OPEC's realized, wait a minute, we can't keep pumping oil into a market that doesn't want the oil. And they've decided to cut back on production. As much as we were oversupplied in the months of really February, March, and April, OPEC allowed us to flipped the switch, and actually, if you look at global inventories, they're actually falling as of May, and that decline in inventory seems to be accelerating into June as you continue to ramp up on the demand side, and OPEC holds off, OPEC and others hold off oil from the market. So it's been extremely volatile. I've been doing this 30 years, and I've never seen anything like this in terms of swings in supply and demand and overall volatility of oil prices. But I think the consequences of this oil price shock in April have been a shutdown in the U.S. oil and gas industry like we've never seen before. Activity in many areas is down 80% from where we were in February. That's just a staggering concept to think that that you've hit overall oil field activity 80% in a matter of just a few months. And the consequences of that will reverberate for years to come. U.S. supply, which has been growing for a decade, it's already rolling over. If you stop drilling oil wells, then there's a thing called decline rates and production declines. And that's exactly what we've done. And so you set the scenario going forward for a sustained undersupplied oil market. So the consequence of these extremes in price are you lead to extremes on the other side. So we go to a negative oil price and activity collapses and people look for oil collapses. And as demand picks up you're not going to be able to respond on the supply side, and I think we're in a position where we're probably going to be undersupplied for years to come, and oil prices are posed to move just as extreme on the upside as we've seen it move on the downside. So, and that's we've already bottomed. It's already turned. And to your point, we're back up to 40 oils, hitting whatever 3-month highs today, and I think we'll continue to see a substantial ramp over the next 18 months. Upward.
You know, one thing you said, you've never seen anything like this in the 30-year history that you've been following the market. Marshall, it was almost like the perfect storm. You had a price war between two of the biggest suppliers, exporters in the world, Russia and Saudi Arabia. And then we've never seen, even in an economic downturn, anything close to what we saw with demand destruction. And it all occurred within a matter of months. That was the other thing that really struck me.
Yeah, it's intriguing. Coming into the year, we were heading into a modestly undersupplied market. Oil prices had been drifting higher. We were up into the $60 range, which is the highest we'd seen in a while. And the fundamentals looked very solid. And then, sure enough, with the COVID outbreak, you absolutely hammer the demand side like we've never seen. But as that began to emerge, you're right. Russia and Saudi got into a battle between each other. And I think Russia's end goal was to see U.S. activity hit and U.S. production fall and make room for more of their oil in the market in the future. And I don't really think that was Saudi's motivation, but they were tired of Russia not contributing to the stability of the oil market. And the combination of those things, you're right, led to in the months preceding the demand meltdown, a battle within OPEC Plus, which really is Saudi and Russia, which seems to have since been resolved. Russia has achieved their goal of severely injuring the U.S. oil and gas business. Saudi has achieved their goal of getting Russia to contribute. And the end result is going to be, I think, sustained higher oil prices for, I would say at least the next 3 years.
You know, what is it, Marshall, as you've been following this industry, what is it about oil that it tends to go to extremes? It's either, I think of what happened to oil in the late 80s, it got down to $10 a barrel. Then it happened again in 98 when it got down to $10 a barrel, jumped to 34, then went down again, then all the way up to 150. We seem to be going from one extreme to another. In other words, can you remember a period of time where oil was just stable at around a price for a long, sustained period of time?
It has happened, but it's you're absolutely correct. It is not common, and the reason is intriguing. When you look at most commodities, if you see supply or demand swing out of balance by a percent or so, let's take oranges as an example, then you see a modest price correction and people say, all right, well, I'm not going to buy as many oranges, or the price falls a little bit and they buy more oranges. In the case of oil, it is such a necessary commodity for everything we do. And if you're short 1%, then you run into gas lines. And so a 1 million barrel a day swing in the market is about a 1% in supply or demand is about a 1% change. Well, that 1% imbalance can lead to a 50% swing in pricing because it is a commodity that we have to have to get to work and to fly airplanes and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so you're right. I mean, that creates the volatility. And you layer in the fact that most of the oil around the world comes from areas that aren't exactly stable, specifically the Middle East. And the end consequence is you tend to get severe fluctuations. Now, again, let's keep in mind a 1% swing can have a massive impact on pricing. We saw, again, some think it's as much as 30%. I think it was a little less than a 20% decline in the month of April, but a 20% move in 1 month when a 1% out of balance wreaks havoc on pricing, that gives you some relevance as to the magnitude of the scale of this problem that happened with the COVID virus.
I want to talk about how demand might change going forward. I mean, you have a slide deck where you talk about, you know, there was a decline of 27% in gasoline, 17% in diesel. The biggest was jet fuel. As the economy comes back, it seems to me that transportation is changing. The Wall Street Journal has done stories about people taking vacations. They're driving, staycations, RV sales are up, but they're less inclined to get on an airplane. Businesses are deciding that, hey, we can do, instead of flying to conferences, we can just do that teleconference. So how do you see this demand being impacted as the economy bounces back, especially with aviation?
Yeah, you have introduced, with these global economic shutdowns, you've accelerated the change in lifestyles that were gradually occurring over time. And I don't think anyone really fully understands all the consequences of what we're going to see going forward. But you hit on the key ones is I think we have to assume at least until certainly there are vaccines and whatnot, limited travel on congested travel venues such as planes, trains, subways, buses, et cetera. The consequence of that is the other side of that coin is that people are driving more. And so you are seeing a very rapid recovery around the world in terms of gasoline consumption. You're actually seeing some areas of the world already up versus where we were pre-virus, which is interesting. Jet fuel is going to be down for quite a while. I do think people are going to change for years their willingness to travel and do international conferences in particular. I think conferences in general, business travel in general, is going to get hit. There will be a structural change in our lifestyles that is being impacted by our success at working from home, our success at working remotely, and I think that is here to stay. To some degree, there's other people I talk to say, well, it still doesn't change. I mean, for us to do business, we have to meet face to face. And so it's not going away permanently, but to some degree, it will be diminished permanently. And so, for example, here's what we're modeling this year. And again, this is the year of the global shutdown. We think global oil demand will be down about 7% for the full year. The peak down a little less than 20% monthly and recovering as we go through this year. Next year, I'm going to model about a 3% permanent reduction in how we use oil and gas, i.e. more Zoom meetings, less air travel, et cetera. And I think that's here to stay. Now, keep in mind, you're still automobile sales in some parts of the world right now are already up. meaningfully year over year because of the shift to, hey, I feel safer doing that. And you're not going to get away from the structural energy consumption growth in developing countries such as China and India. So even though our lifestyle changes will kind of create a step down in demand, from there, demand's still going to go up, right? There's still going to be more people in India driving cars. There's still going to be more oil and gas consumption in China over time and other third world countries as they emerge into developed status. And so, 3% is a pretty aggressive assumption on permanent lifestyle changes. I suspect it won't be that bad once vaccines are out there and everything else, but I figure that's a safe thing to model. And if you assume that, global demand does not return to 2019 levels until at the earliest sometime in late 22, and it could easily be till 2023.
So let's talk about on the other side, on the supply. The rig count has literally fallen off a cliff. And Marshall, I'm just thinking, going back to 2014 when we had the first price war with Saudi Arabia, and then, of course, what's happened recently, a lot of the big oil companies and investments in general to keep up with declining production, this thing called depletion, has been absent. How long before that starts to catch up with us?
One of the characteristics of this shale revolution is that they tend to be very high decline rate wells, particularly in the first few years of the well's life. And so there, versus any other time in history, we should see a very sharp correction, particularly in U.S. shale-related production. And so that's already happening. You're seeing it just after a few months. Now, there was some shut-ins that occurred because we had to due to low pricing in April. The market sent the signal to, hey, you guys need to scale it back. And they did. They voluntarily curtailed. But structurally, we think you're already starting to see the consequences of an 80% reduction in fracking activity, of a 70%+ reduction in rigs that are probably going to continue falling. And so the consequences of that are going to last for a long time. For example, I think U.S. production of crude next year will be down around 2.5 million barrels a day, off of a base of 13 million barrels a day. So that is a staggering hit to U.S. production, which by the way, we're well on our way to being energy independent and energy, or at least oil and gas independent and self-sufficient. And that blows that out of the water, right? When you lose, you know, that much production, low teens in 1 year, wow, that's a big deal. And if the futures price is correct, that will be down another million barrels a day in the following year. And so that's why I'm, the demand's been hit, but it's already coming back. But the production is going to continue falling again at the prices indicated by the futures market. Production will continue falling for at least 2, probably 3 years. And so as those supply and demand numbers shift, let's say we get back to 2019 production or demand, sometime in 22. Well, production's going to be down huge by then because of these prices. So that's why my modeling suggests that we are going to be severely short crude sometime in the back half of next year.
You know, I want to hit something. You're talking about demand. We've been talking about supply. The media has been hammering this idea that we've reached peak demand, that somehow, Marshall, our transportation fleet is going to be electric in the next 10 years. I just don't see that. I just don't see the vast amount of Americans driving around in electric cars and the whole transportation fleet converted in a decade. I don't know. I may be wrong, but I just don't see it.
Well, a couple points there. First of all, keep in mind that the transformation to electric vehicles is occurring due largely to government mandates and taxpayers around the world funding that transition. And so the only way electric vehicles can compete right now is by government subsidies and or government mandates. Even with all of those mandates and massive subsidies to the industry over the past decade, and particularly in the last 5 years, electric automobiles account for, get this, 0.3% of the world's automobile fleet. Let me repeat that. After all these massive subsidies and all this hype over electric cars, and hey, the Teslas are really cool cars, but you know, range anxiety and other things have allowed Tesla and others to amount to 0.3%, not 3%, but 0.3% of the total cars on the road today globally are electric. So we're going to somehow fully transition to electric in 10 years. That's ridiculous to even contemplate. It doesn't make any sense. And who's going to pay for that, right? I mean, if subsidies are driving, and okay, you can subsidize 0.3% of the fleet or maybe even 3% of the fleet, but to subsidize 30% of the fleet, that, you know, at some point in time, that doesn't make sense.
So given this and the fact that oil is critical to almost anything we do, whether it's transportation or just the byproducts, oil from plastic to half of the items that are in your home, how does this translate into investment? We've seen a lot of the smaller shale producers are having trouble getting financing, and even the big guys are struggling to maintain some of their dividends, with Royal Dutch cutting its dividend for the first time since World War II. How do you play this?
Well, a couple of things are likely to happen in my mind. Number one, you are going to see this supply demand for crude is already rebalanced. I mean, we're already undersupplied today. Now, you got to work off a lot of these inventories, and that will take through this year to get back to kind of normalized levels of inventory. So as you do that, the price of oil goes up, and then you move into 21, and oh no, we're short, and maybe we're way too short. So the price of oil goes through the roof, right? And I think there's very real possibility of triple-digit oil next year, i.e. $100-plus oil. And again, it's just the other side of the coin of taking oil to negative prices that we did early this year. And so that's number one. Number two, you're exactly right. The industry that extracts oil and natural gas as well from the ground that allow us to have these things, that, you know, automobiles and plastics, but people forget, you know, in the clothes you're wearing right now, there is a substantial amount of hydrocarbon products in those. And so it's everything that we live with has usually some type of hydrocarbon related to it. And so that's just going to become more expensive. And the people that extract it aren't allowed to get capital right now. So whenever I've gone through these major downturns, and I saw it in the mid to late 80s, again in the late 90s. These are, you know, career building opportunities to make outsized returns. When everyone hates something as much as they hate energy right now, and as little cap availability as there is right now, when prices do go up and the profits do return, then these companies are going to be killing it in terms of profitability. So it almost doesn't matter which subsector of the energy group you look at. I would say generically the most damaged companies have been the oil service names, and frankly half of those are still facing bankruptcy today. So that's your ultra high risk, high reward play there, but you got to be very careful and pick the names that aren't going to go bankrupt. Next is E&Ps. They've been hit. There's going to be some bankruptcies, but not as many as in the service side. We've already seen a few occur in the E&P side. But those guys, I think, when you look at even a return to a $70 oil world, which I think is kind of a minimum price we're going to need sustained, then E&P companies ought to be throwing off, a 10% yield plus 10 to 15% growth on top of that for a sustained period of time. And so I think there's going to be, and there needs to be outsized returns generated by these companies as we go into 21, 22, 20, 23. So You know, E&Ps, I'm a little more comfortable with you buying those. Pipelines, interestingly, are a little tougher because volumes are going to go down for a couple of years, and that's generally not good for pipes. And midstream is what we call that. Now, that said, they always trade with oil. So if oil goes up, those stocks are going to go up too. It's just they won't do as good in earnings. They won't have as robust recovering earnings as the oil service and the E&P names will have. So high risk, high reward service guys, you know, still, you know, above average risk, but above average reward E&Ps. And then you go down from there with the midstream and refiners.
All right. Well, listen, Marshall, you're a prolific writer with some really great analysis. If our listeners like to follow your work, how could they do so?
Well, they just get on the Raymond James website and track it down. We have a bunch of stuff that we publish. We do a Monday morning think piece, our team does. And you get on the Raymond James website, and it'll take you there.
All right. Well, listen, Marshall, stay well, and thanks for coming on the program.
You bet. Thank you.
Do you dream about throwing out the alarm clock so you can travel, enjoy your hobbies, or just relax? You've worked hard for decades and want to cash in on all that hard work. Now it's time to develop a plan that can help you get there. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today to get your retirement plan started. We can help to make sure you have the income you need to live the lifestyle you want, how to maximize government benefits from Social Security to Medicare, reduce taxes and plan for future inflation, or protect your assets with an estate plan. Don't leave your retirement up to chance. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
Welcome, everyone, to this week's Smart Macro. As always, we are joined today by Financial Sense Wealth Management's CIO, Chris Poplava. Chris, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
Chris, you just wrote an excellent article, and we're going to have it posted where this interview is located at Financial Sense. But it's titled, "When the Facts Change, I Change My Mind. What Do You Do, Sir?" And that is a quote that has been attributed to John Maynard Keynes, the famous economist. And I suppose that title is reflective of the recent change that we made at our firm in terms of the investment strategy. So if you would mind, give us a recap of where things have been, at least in terms of our positioning and strategy over the past few months, maybe at the start of the year, since we're now closing the first half of 2020, moving into the second half, and then also tell us about the recent change and why we did that.
Going into this year, there's really two big developments that gave us a bullish outlook. Number one, we had the Fed injecting stimulus as it was expanding its balance sheet with the repo crisis that we had in September of 2019. Further, we reached a trade deal with China, and that was injecting a huge amount of uncertainty into the global market for the last 2 years. So removing that uncertainty, moving towards a phase one trade deal with China, plus the world's biggest central bank, the US Fed, moving towards adding stimulus to the market. Those are two really big reasons why we felt that this would be a 2020 would be a recovery year, that global growth would bottom and pick up, and that risk assets would be performing well in light of the increased stimulus. And consequently, because of that, you know, usually when economic growth picks up, you tend to see a rise in interest rates. And so in terms of our accounts for our clients, we were overweight equities and we were underweight bonds. And at the same time, we had a short maturity portfolio for our fixed income because we felt that long-term interest rates would rise this year, which typically do with economic growth. That came to a screeching halt in February when it became clear that this was not the COVID-19 infection was not just isolated to China, but was beginning to expand into other countries like South Korea and Iran and Italy. And as it became clear that it would truly become a pandemic, that was when forecasts began to be slashed and the outlook dramatically changed for 2020. And beginning in February, we started to raise cash, and mostly by selling our more economically sensitive areas like energy and so forth. But as we entered early March and we continued to see how things were transpiring, we then moved towards a minimum risk posture. And that helped us to miss a lot of the real steep decline that happened in the middle of March. However, we did not anticipate the dramatic decline in interest rates. So on the bond side, say we didn't quite get that right. But overall, really de-risking our accounts in terms of our equity exposure helped. And then further, once we saw the market down 35% plus, you could, on two hands, you can count the number of times the market's been down by 35% or more. We saw that as a buying opportunity, as there was tremendous value in the market and we began to put cash to work. That pushed us more towards a neutral position on the stock market, which we've largely held until recently.
As we discussed with you 2 weeks ago, we had been in this neutral posture with our clients and portfolios. But at this point, we've now moved a bit more defensively over the past 2 weeks. So what has been the cause of this most recent change in terms of how we're positioned?
So our change in positioning, we were at about a neutral position in equities. We're now closer to a minimum risk position as we've sold some equities starting last week and a little more so the early part of this week. And the reason for that is looking at the COVID outbreak, where we've had a huge spike in certain states, which is surprising because the consensus was of the belief that the coronavirus outbreak would follow the influenza virus, which typically you see the flu season begin to die off as we go into the summer months. That clearly hasn't been the case, as we're seeing a pickup in multiple states as we've reopened. And in particular, in California, Florida, Texas, and Arizona, especially Texas, Florida, and Arizona, they're now seeing almost an exponential growth in daily cases. So in light of that, that is going to mean if we continue to see this, we may see more and more cases as we go through the summer months, so that when we enter the next flu season, the 2020-21 season, we might have hundreds of thousands of cases. So we've seen an exponential rise in Texas, Florida, and Arizona. And the concern is that that's going to continue to build in those states as well as the other states as we enter the next flu season. And in the article that we're going to post on the site, one of the things I show is the active cases for COVID-19, both globally and in the U.S. And you can see when you look at that chart, we essentially entered March with very little cases. I think globally we had around 36,000 active cases. In the U.S., as we entered early February to March, we had around 8 active cases. Just right now in the U.S., we have over 1.6 million active cases, and there's over 4.3 million active cases globally. So if we continue to see the number of active cases build throughout the summer, going into the fall, that's going to create a lot of concern that we might have a second bigger wave than the first wave of the COVID outbreak.
Well, Chris, with the recent surge that you have and you show here in this piece, and I would highly encourage all of our listeners to look at the data that you're tracking. You've compiled it. You've made some really nice data visualization tools and charts that people can use to see some of these things for themselves. But going back to the states that you mentioned where we are seeing a surge in cases, how is this impacting their respective economies and how does this change the outlook?
A good example is the primary impact is in healthcare. For example, I show a chart of Arizona looking at the percent utilization of ICU beds. And in early March, Arizona had roughly around 60% of their ICU beds were being used. And that slowly began to increase over the last 2 months to where now they're approaching almost a 90% utilization rate of their ICU beds. And if you look at Texas, just this week alone, they met full capacity for their ICU beds. And they're projecting by early July, they're going to exceed their sustainable surge capacity just after July 4th. So there's clearly a huge strain on the healthcare sector for those states, which is why we've seen a dramatic shift coming from the Florida governor as well as the Texas governor, in which they're starting to slow down their reopening phases.
Where else are you seeing this, when we think about ripple effects or other impacts?
Well, I isolated the three states that are seeing an exponential rise in COVID cases, and that's Florida, Texas, and Arizona. And we can see that their percent of time spent outside, so think of mobility, it took a dramatic plunge in March and then bottomed in April. And we saw a slow improvement, going into the early part of May. But since late May into this month, we've actually seen mobility flatline where there's no more improvement. And that's a concern in terms of recovery for those economies. If the percent of time that consumers are out shopping at malls, going to the movies and restaurants, that's going to impact the Arizona or those states' economies. And it's not just, you know, consumer mobility. It's also looking at what small businesses, what's going on there in recent trends. If you look at small business revenue in those three states, they saw a dramatic decline throughout March and going into April, but they've had a fairly strong recovery off those lows. However, over the last month, we've started to see that recovery in small business revenue begin to roll over again. And that's a huge concern. And the main culprit for that is you've started to see small businesses in those three states begin to shut down once more. So instead of seeing more and more businesses open, we've already seen a peak in those states, and that occurred late May, and now we're seeing the number of businesses open in those states decline. So that's a big concern, and especially when you look at those states, you know, there's some data that's suggesting we're kind of flatlining here across the board. And one area is department stores, brick and mortar stores. We've seen same store sales growth had a roughly a 45% contraction year over year as we entered April. And we've virtually stayed at that level. And because of the sustained decline in department store sales, we've seen a lot of layoffs recently. Macy's just slashed 3,900 corporate jobs with their restructuring plans. We're continuing to see layoffs in Coach, Kate Spade, Fashion House, and others. And if this COVID outbreaks move in the wrong direction, I think we're going to continue to see retail and restaurants and other types of industries that are impacted by the outbreak and shutdowns begin to see those pick up. You know, if you look at the last month or two, you know, one of the positive stories was unemployment claims. When we get that data weekly, they were beginning to decline. And so that was the thought that we've turned the corner. And then also the May jobs report saw a huge surge in employment. But if we continue to see the COVID outbreak move in the wrong direction, that's when I think we're going to see more and more layoffs in the weeks ahead.
Andrew Zatlin, who's the number one forecaster tracked by Bloomberg on jobless claims, discussed on FS Insider this week how we are seeing a second wave of layoffs right now that are taking place. And these are more concentrated now on white collar jobs versus where we saw in the first wave that took place in March with the initial shutdowns. Those that were able to work from home were relatively unscathed. He says now we're starting to see that work its way up into the white collar workforce. He wasn't particularly concerned about that and did say that he thought that this second wave would be smaller than the first wave. I think that's a pretty safe assumption. And we're hoping that's the case, you know, given that we won't see the degree of lockdowns that we saw back in March happen again this time if we do see a pickup in COVID infection rates. But obviously, we're going to have to see how that plays out. And again, at this point, given what you said about retail sales and some of these other items that you point to in your article, there are reasons to be cautious right here. There's a big uncertainty with the elections coming up as well. A number of things that we can look at. And that's why, given what you said, you know, we are moving more defensively, more recently, just this past week or so, and have moved more towards a minimum risk posture when it comes to the stock market. Anything else that you're looking at, you know, when it comes to the stock market in particular? You do have a graph here I think is really interesting, showing the NASDAQ and all the different components of it, the different companies that comprise the NASDAQ, and just how big some of these companies are. Where does this fit into the investment landscape as you see it?
You know, if you look at the stock market, which is pretty surprising, is to hear, you know, some of the news stories that I'm sure you've heard on the news that the NASDAQ composite hit an all-time high, even exceeding its February high. You've got Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, all these other companies hitting all-time new highs, and yet the economy is really, really suffering. But even if you look at the Dow and you look at the S&P 500, they've largely retraced their decline, not 100%, but a sizable amount, where they've essentially had a V-shaped recovery. And a lot of people have, you know, asked the question, you know, what is it that is, what's the disconnect between the stock market and the economy? And I really don't think there is a disconnect. When you drill down into the data, it actually makes a lot more sense when you look at what's going on, where the market is primarily being driven by the tech sector and a handful of mega cap names, while the average stock is not performing so well and more resembles the economy in terms of bottoming in March and having a more moderated recovery. One of the charts that we show in the article is the 11 sectors in the S&P and how their weights have changed since 2007. For example, if you look at the technology sector, it was less than 16% of the S&P in 2007, and yet it's nearly 28% recently. And that's primarily come from a loss in importance from the financial and energy sectors, which were so heavy going into the last downturn. But you can really see this, and we put a great graphic together for our clients and readers to see, is looking at a bubble chart of the S&P 500 and showing each sector and how big it is relative to the other sectors, as well as the companies that make up that sector. And, when you do that, you can clearly see that, Apple and Microsoft, Google and Amazon, they're dramatically huge in size relative to the rest of the members. It's kind of like comparing California to Rhode Island, where Apple's California in terms of U.S. state economic growth. You know, if you want to know what's going to happen in the United States economy, follow some states like California, New York, Texas, Florida, and you have a pretty good handle where things are. Same thing with the stock market. By following only a handful of companies that have an outside influence, you can understand, what's driving the actual market, where literally four companies make up the bulk of the NASDAQ composite. And these sectors are pretty much making and dominating the returns for this year. One of the other charts that we show that I think tells a really interesting story is the percentage point contribution to the S&P's return year to date throughout this year. And going into February and even late February, the bulk of the S&P's return was coming from one sector, which was the tech sector. All the other sectors only had a marginal influence on the S&P's return, but then everything rolled over in February. But if you look recently, the NASDAQ is positive on the year, the technology sector is positive on the year, and yet the S&P is negative. So if you look at the S&P's performance, it would be far worse if you stripped out the technology sector. So, really, this is not a stock picker's market. It's a very thin market. While the average stock or median stock is not doing well. One of the tables that we included in the article was looking at what the index's year-to-date return was relative to what the median member's return is. And this is as of yesterday on the June 25th. The NASDAQ composite was up 10.7%, yet its median member, and the NASDAQ has thousands of members in it, and the median stock within that was down 16% for the year. We're talking a 27% difference in performance between the NASDAQ and its composite members. And we see similar trends, not as dramatic, when we look at the S&P 500 large cap or S&P 400 mid cap or 600 small cap. But the point being is the average stock in the mid-cap and small-cap space, they're in bear markets still, year-to-date, down more than 20%. While if you look at the S&P, it's only off by 5%. Its median stock is down over 14%. So I think this really highlights that tech is doing the heavy lifting, and we're kind of having somewhat of a bubble in that sector, while the average stock has not recouped its losses and is actually reflecting more of the reality or reflecting more of the economic reality that is currently taking place.
Well, Chris, in sum, as you mentioned today, we have moved from a neutral to a more defensive minimum risk posture towards the stock market, given a number of the things that we discussed. And again, I do want to point out that you have a long list of charts and data that I think are very important for everyone to take a look at. We'll have a link to that article where this interview is located on Financial Sense. Any lasting comments?
We saw a huge decline in March, and that was quickly met with stimulus. I think there's more stimulus to come, and that is what I believe will likely cushion the downturn. As of right now, I do not think we're going to retest the March lows. I think we do have some weakness ahead, but not as dramatic as retesting the March lows. And part of that is there's still a lot of cash on the sidelines. Plus, we've got, I believe, more future stimulus coming, both monetary and fiscal. And I think that will help to cushion the blow. And also, if we begin to see compelling valuations again, will likely go back into the market and put some cash to work at more attractive levels. But for us, you know, when we looked at the market retracing the bulk of its decline, we felt it was prudent to take some chips off the table. That's what we did. But again, we won't hesitate to put money to work if we feel it's appropriate.
Chris, as always, if any of our listeners would like to get a hold of you to discuss any of the things that you brought up today or to see how Financial Sense Wealth Management can help them with their investment needs, what would be the best way to get a hold of you?
They can send me an email at chris.paplava@financialsense.com.
Chris, we look forward to speaking with you in another 2 weeks.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.